I'm here with Alex Marthews of Restore the Fourth. Hello, Alex. Thank you for joining me on the show tonight.
Hello, Chuck. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right, aside from the fact that I keep forgetting that the podcast could be listened to at any hour. So even though we are in the evening right now, Alex is joining us today, tonight, tomorrow, whenever you happen to be listening to the podcast. So, Alex, I'd like to start by asking you to tell me a little bit about who you are and telling me a little bit about who Restore the Fourth are.
Sure. I am the national chair of Restore the Fourth. I started getting interested in the whole topic of civil liberties and what we do online and the Fourth Amendment back in 2000, 2001. I was at grad school in the Bay Area, and it was the time of the dot-com boom, and there was a lot of exciting stuff going on with the commercialization of the internet. But it also seemed to me like it was not being adequately theorized what would happen with all of this data and what would happen to people's lives as a consequence of people's data being cheaply collected and modified and shared. I fell in with some folks at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I did an internship there for a while. They apparently wanted a British voice, and I was only recently arrived from the United Kingdom. They wanted somebody who could speak to what was happening then in terms of investigatory powers and the regulation thereof in the UK setting. I looked into Carnivore and Echelon and all of these intrusive pre-9/11 programs on their behalf. But what I also found was that at UC Berkeley at that time, I was at policy school, and there was an awful lot of sophisticated thinking going on, for example, healthcare economics or housing or welfare provision of various kinds. But there wasn't a single course that was probing into this new phenomenon of the commercial internet. I helped to design UC Berkeley's first course on what we were calling cyber law at the time, and try to help people start to look at those issues a bit. Thing is, at that time, the whole sphere of online civil liberties and what to do with it was a very, very small field. And so finding an actual job for which people would pay me a recognized currency in the space was more challenging than you might think. And I found myself working on other interesting causes in the nonprofit space for some years. That included historic preservation and girls' education in Africa and topics like that. But I continued to be interested and worried by what the Bush administration was up to. There is much I still haven't forgiven them for and never will. But the whole warrantless surveillance scandal, what they were doing with military commissions, the distinctions they were placing between a nominal protection of the rights of US citizens and a complete dismissal of the rights of everybody else were troubling to me. So I kept a close eye on the policy area, and it seemed to grow increasingly demented. Congress finds out about the presidential post-9/11 warrantless surveillance, and then their reaction is not, this is bad and unconstitutional and we should shut it down. Their reaction was, but you didn't tell us. You left us out of it.
It's rather like it's not so much that we didn't authorize this as it is you didn't deal us in.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And so the whole stuff of what became the FISA Amendments Act of 2008, that was Congress not saying, you know, we don't like what you're doing. They were saying, deal us in, exactly. Then you started to have very interesting stuff happening with the Occupy movement and with Anonymous. And I was watching what was happening in terms of state surveillance of those entities because I was interested in them. Then you had James Clapper coming before Congress and declaring that they did not, in fact, conduct warrantless surveillance on the American people. And that, in turn, was the spur for Edward Snowden to come out of the NSA.
That remark, was it not, was the one that was described as being too cute by half?
Mm-hmm. Yes. That's right. And he later said, as part of his efforts to fend off perjury charges, that he had given the least untruthful answer that he could in an unclassified setting.
That's
In other
lovely.
words, he loved it.
Yes, of course.
You can't handle the truth, I think is the phrase. So by that time, I had gotten US citizenship, and I was in a position where I had the choice as to whether I would work on other people's causes or whether I could set up a nonprofit and work on a cause myself. This was a cause I desperately cared about, and I set up a small activist group in Massachusetts in 2012, working on questions of wiretapping and privacy and surveillance. And then, 10 months later, Edward Snowden comes out of the NSA. And at that juncture, protest groups start springing up and self-organizing on Reddit. He came out of the NSA in early June, and these groups wanted to hold a big protest on July 4th of that year. And they started organizing around the slogan of Restore the Fourth. Yeah, there were rallies in over 100 cities, not just in the US, but in Canada and in Western Europe and a few other places. And the folks who were running that started to do more organizing and more protesting, and there were daily intense IRC chats. And by the fall, a lot of folks were getting a little bit burned out, and some folks needed to sort of go and earn money for a living rather than working full time on something they weren't being paid for. So they started looking around Christmas of 2013 for a new national chair who could help them figure out what do we do when we are not necessarily going to be on the streets every week? What kinds of policy agenda should we pursue? How can we actually stop this array of government surveillance, or at least throw sand in the gears of it? Develop a strategy, incorporate it as a nonprofit, raise a little money. It would help if the person had some nonprofit experience and didn't necessarily immediately need a salary right then. So I applied, a few other people applied, and they picked me, and I've remained as national chair since then. I folded my own organization into Restore the Fourth. Chapters continued in other places. We have chapters, for example, in Minneapolis and in Providence and New York City, and in the San Francisco Bay Area, and associated groups in Seattle and New Orleans, and different places. What we have evolved into is a lobbying group, basically. We're a 501c4, for those who know what that is, which means that people can give us money, but they won't get a tax break for it. But on the other hand,
But the other hand, you are able to get involved in politics, which a 501c3 would not.
Yes, that is basically true. They can do it to a small degree, but the paperwork requirements are very heavy.
Oh dear.
Paperwork requirements for 501c4s are very light because we live in a massively corrupt system of political fundraising. And 501c4s, which are sometimes referred to as dark money groups, are very advantageous for both parties. And so both parties have an incentive to make them be very lightly regulated. So this is good. I don't like a ton of paperwork, but we do provide much more transparency than we are theoretically required to under these laws, just because we want to. We have focused really on two things: local organizing to stop secret police surveillance is one major element, and that can involve, for example, passing an ordinance that means that your local police department can't just talk to a software vendor and acquire what it wants to on its own initiative. There are plenty of vendors with plenty of solutions that always seem to involve intrusive and massive collections of data on the general public. And we tend to feel that for those software solutions and for other technological solutions in the surveillance technology space, it is good for the public to have a say over what happens, for elected officials to know about it, which they wouldn't otherwise, and for there to be things like public hearings.
That's a path that I'd like to go down a little bit more depth in a few minutes. before we do that, I wanted to go back and revisit your time in the Bay Area.
Oh, yeah. We were talking about 99 through to 05 was the time I was there.
We're talking round about the time that the EFF first came into existence, for that matter.
Well, they started up a little earlier than that. In 1992, I believe it was, there was a case called Steve Jackson Games.
Very familiar with it. I've talked about it many times on this podcast.
There you go. And as part of the fallout from the Steve Jackson Games case, there was, I think, a $250,000 donation that established EFF. But it is true that in 2000 to 2001, when I was interning there, they were much smaller than they are now. So they've become very large and sophisticated.
Now, what I find fascinating about this particular aspect of that period of your life is that, to my understanding, you're not an overly technical person.
No. My professional background is in public policy. My college major was medieval literature.
Which I'm sure has come in very handy in this pursuit.
Absolutely. I would never admit to anything else. But what it does mean is that we have a lot of technical people with high skills involved with Restore the Fourth. It's a good fit for people who are of a technical mindset, who want to be able to find ways of translating that expertise in a way that's intelligible for lawmakers. We all know that members of Congress don't tend to have technical backgrounds either. They don't tend to know what they're doing when they're trying to regulate the internet one way or another. So it can help to have somebody or multiple somebodies who are used to the language of policy trying to help tech-oriented people figure out what to say and how to say it. But it is true that because of this sort of background and configuration of Restore the Fourth, we have been called the nerdiest civil liberties organization on the Hill.
Very nice.
That's great. I love that.
I do too. One of the things that I find interesting about this too is that for the listeners, I will mention that we are carrying out this conversation using Signal Private Messenger, which is, in my opinion, a particularly nerdy tool to use. So I find it interesting that somebody who is not of a particularly technical background has chosen this tool. Tell me a little bit about your thoughts on using a tool that level of sophistication and how you feel it is as far as its user-friendliness and such.
Well, first of all, God bless the Signal Foundation. I love those guys. Second, when we started off with this organization, we were trying to use PGP email internally.
Oh, heaven help you.
It was not the easiest thing and still is not. I very much respect the peer-to-peer nature of PGP communication, but that I had a lot of trouble with.
Yes, indeed.
So having a tool that honestly is very user-friendly compared to PGP is wonderful. And I can comfortably recommend it to everyone that I get in contact with in this policy space. It's difficult for elected officials to use, not because it's hard to use in itself, but because there is a conflict between using a properly end-to-end encrypted system and public records laws.
Sure, okay, that's an understandable conflict. But I think that for the average user, it seems to be usable. From my perspective, I understand PGP well enough to use it. I still, even as a technical individual, don't find it easy to use. So I certainly can feel your pain on that one. But Signal is just a simple load and go, and it seems to work well enough. I've spoken before, and I will mention again, one particularly noteworthy thing about the Signal Foundation is that they do occasionally get a subpoena, and when they respond to these subpoenas, it's hilarious, because these subpoenas have got this big, long list of things that the agency or whoever is issuing the subpoena would love to get from the Signal Foundation, and the Signal Foundation says, we have a phone number and we have a time at which the account was first and most recently used. Sorry, yep, that's all we got.
Can't do anything more, and that is as it should be. As a last note on Signal, one conversation I'm engaging with other civil liberties advocacy people is trying to encourage them when they're having video calls and strategy calls to switch that environment over to Signal, because we are literally doing organizing against government surveillance. Why would we not organize using a platform that is not going to be able to give metadata when faced with a subpoena? We don't want our opponents to be able to straightforwardly map our networks.
Well, we are on the topic of security-enhancing technologies. Are there others that you recommend to a general non-technical audience?
Well, for the first level of people who are engaging, and we often have volunteers coming along who are not particularly technical, then I encourage them to explore using ProtonMail and ProtonDrive. I think that those tools have gotten better over time. The limitation, obviously, is that email is only end-to-end encrypted if it's ProtonMail to ProtonMail in that environment. So in that sense, it's not like PGP. Obviously, for secure browsing, for people who are taking that seriously, it is difficult to recommend anything other than Tor. And getting people familiar with that environment can be a useful thing. But these are not the only tools that are out there. And I've learned that when you're giving people security advice, you have to fit it to people's threat model, right? So I wasn't able to persuade my family to have their chats over a Signal. That was a little much. My brother lives in China, and apparently there are difficulties there. But we were able to coordinate around using WhatsApp. And there are worse providers than WhatsApp from a security perspective. It's better than trying to chat via SMS. So it's an improvement relative to what we were doing as a family before. Any government may have and may hoard zero-day vulnerabilities that other people don't know about. I know that for my brother, for anything other than face-to-face communication, he would be reluctant to express particularly controversial opinions, which is why sometimes conversation with my brother is tricky.
Yes, I would imagine so.
Because I have a ton of controversial opinions.
I couldn't possibly imagine why you would. So you started down the path of talking about commercial surveillance. So talk to us a little bit about the little snitch in your pocket, as I like to call it.
Oh boy, the indispensable snitch in your pocket is the problem. An enormous amount of modern life is run through the snitches in our pockets. And I think that it is unfair to expect people to diverge entirely away from using a tool that is so radically convenient and makes so many things easier in their lives. There are going to be some people who consciously do diverge away from that, and I respect that immensely. But I think that there are important ways that one can try to use phones in more secure and intelligent ways. And the education that we can provide there is by, for example, talking about data breaches and exploitation of information that is gathered through people's phones, talking about the ecosystem of snitch apps. For example, I have four kids. They have a ton of apps that on the surface are exciting little hamster games where you can have your hamster get exciting little bits of food. And underneath the surface, they are sharing data with 47 different data brokers, plus a couple of nation states, probably including Al-Qaeda, you know. So I'm aware that there are risks involved in the Al-Qaeda hamster game.
I'm amused by that because I'm a father of two myself, and at one point in time, I had to give my son explicit instructions that the Amazon Dot that he had won at the arcade was never, ever to appear on the household Wi-Fi network if he wanted to retain his access. So I completely feel your pain on that one.
It happens. But, you know, there are better and there are worse apps. There is better and worse hardware. I think the important thing for people to be conscious of is that when they are signing up for a service or when they are purchasing hardware, a lot comes with those agreements. And there are a lot of generally very permissive arrangements in terms of how law enforcement requests for data work from those services and from those hardware providers. And so you have to be aware of what you are getting into, and therefore you can modulate what you put online and what you put on what hardware and what software you use and for what purpose. So a more conscious use is helpful. That, of course, is not the only thing that one can do, because that still leaves people very vulnerable. What we therefore do is we focus legislatively on matters to do with data brokers, matters to do particularly with the interface between data brokers and government acquisition of data broker data, and try to ensure that there is some kind of wall of separation, that the expectation is that more companies will do the kind of things that Signal do. They will structure themselves such that they are not collecting sensitive data if they don't really need it, that they are not retaining data beyond its useful life, that if they do collect and retain data, then they have a sensible process whereby they're not simply saying yes to any government entity that wants to walk in the door and ask for the movements of a woman who has come to a blue state looking for an abortion, you know?
Yes, indeed. And I'm glad you brought that up, because that kind of brings me around to one of the other thoughts that has been on my mind since the overturn of Roe some months back. And that concerns the tracking of people who do travel to blue states for that purpose or for any other otherwise legitimate purpose. One of the aspects that I think a lot of people don't give enough thought to as well is their vehicles. We live in America. It's really difficult to get by without a vehicle unless you're lucky enough to live in a city that is walkable and has decent public transit. And unfortunately, there are only a few of those. And the situation that puts us in is that we have got not just the snitch in our pocket, but we've got the snitch on four wheels as well. What do we do about that and the end user license agreement that we are faced with the first time we turn our key that appears on our handy dandy iPhone-like screen in the center of our console?
It is difficult. I believe that Mozilla came forward with an analysis a few months ago of the vehicular data space. They were trying to help inform consumers on which car makers were better to go with. And their conclusion was, no, actually, all of you suck. We cannot possibly give anything other than a failing grade to any of you.
Sure.
They did specify that Tesla was particularly bad. But there has been this assumption that car makers can gather an increasing variety of data, and that in turn, law enforcement can access that data with relatively little process. At the same time, there have been legislative initiatives that, in the context of that mass data collection, look very worrying. So, for example, you may remember a couple of years ago, there was an infrastructure bill that was put out by Congress, and that was a central plank of what Biden in the early years of his administration was looking to do. Massive bill, over 1,000 pages, there was one page of it that specified that by, I think it was by around now, all new cars manufactured in the United States would have to have some technological mechanism installed for detecting driver impairment and for enabling remote stopping of the engine in the context of a finding of driver impairment. Now, we're not saying that drunk driving isn't a serious thing. Of course,
Certainly.
It's a serious thing. A lot of people die from it. On the other hand, a lot of the technologies that are promised in this space appear to be kind of vaporware-like. They aren't trying to do the things that they ought to be doing. They're collecting a ton of data always, but it's not necessarily the data that you would need in order to achieve the end in view. And meanwhile, they're being extremely intrusive. So let me explain that. You've got this technological mandate in the law, written probably by somebody who is not a technical person. And they say, you know, driver impairment is bad. Do something technological with your wizardry to detect driver impairment. Well, how do you do that? There are a number of ways. You could, for example, install facial recognition equipped cameras within the car and apply an algorithm that classifies the driver as looking drunk or not. And then people who have exceptionally florid noses, for whatever reason, are out of luck, whether they are impaired at the time or not. You could have emotion recognition software, which purports to examine whether somebody is acting a bit impaired behind the wheel, or whether perhaps they are too angry or emotional to be safely able to drive. Now, this may be telling on myself a little bit here, but in truth, I have four children, and I cannot promise that at all times when I have been in my vehicle, my facial expression has been a model of quiet calm. You could have atmospheric sensors in the car that detect alcohol within the car because it's a volatile compound.
Sure.
And when it's above a certain level, they would stop the car. And that might be a little closer to what is required with respect to alcohol. But then on the other hand, what if you're a designated driver and you're transporting a gang of drunk teenagers because you had to go out and get them because nobody is going to want them to come home under their own steam in that condition? Well, then you're going to get penalized and you're not going to be able to operate your car because there's now a legally mandated remote kill switch.
And of course, we all know that this legally mandated kill switch will never, ever be abused for any other purpose.
Absolutely not. Chuck, we just don't have that kind of government. What would make you think that they would use all of the technological capacities that they have to hand to shut down the physical movements or financial movements or activities in general of people they don't like? I can't imagine there being an extensive, decades-long history amply demonstrated by documentaries and historians and books shelves long as to why that might be a bad idea.
Yeah. Drawing a complete blank on that one myself.
Knew you would. So there you go. Nothing to worry about.
We Nothing to see here. Move clear. Along.
Yeah, fine. But that vote was an interesting one, and I'll tell you why. There was a vote on an amendment to strip that language, and it didn't have much play in the press. And the amendment did not succeed in stripping that language. But two of the people who voted to strip that language were Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on the left and Thomas Massie on the right. And that showcases that both on the left and the right, there can be legislators who are alive to the privacy consequences of new technologies and who maybe understand these things a little better than some of their colleagues do. Meanwhile, of course, having that language in there is a bonanza for whatever vaporware salesman wants to come along to, is it called Stellantis now or Ford or whatever, and say, you have a new legal mandate. I have software that I'm going to declare will help with this. Give me like $10 million in the first year with nice little upgrades for 1.0 and 2.0 and 3.0 and 4.0. Let's do a deal here. And Of course, the concern of the car makers is to satisfy that legal mandate. So why not?
Well, there is the component, yes, of the car makers being interested in satisfying the mandate. The flip, however, would be that the car makers will also be interested in monetizing whatever data they are able to collect over these tools.
Well, wouldn't that be unfortunate? But it would be a deeply regrettable incidental side effect that nobody, of course, intended that they could make some substantial profits out of that.
And I will, of course, include a link to the podcast episode in which I talk about exactly that happening when the insurers got a hold of this information.
Well, there you go. You see, everyone, it doesn't have to be done in on the basis of segmentation anymore. You're in your own individual personalized segment for insurance purposes. And if you happen to be not just living in an area that has a high rate of car crime, but if you happen to be a person who triggers whatever software is installed for one reason or another, then sucks to be you, buddy.
So we've talked about the commercialization of data. We've talked about commercial surveillance, I should say, to be more specific. Talk to me a little bit about how the commercial data makes its way around the Fourth Amendment.
Well, this is a really interesting topic, so thank you for bringing it up. We need to think to begin with about the broad question of how does government gather the information that it wants? And remember, I'm a public policy guide. The whole notion of public policy is that government decisions will be better taken if they are based on data rather than if they are based on prejudice. And so the whole orientation of public policy as a field is let's get the right data to decision makers, and then they will make better decisions. It causes heartburn to my former grad school colleagues that I'm professionally now in a field where I'm often saying, no, you actually need to gather less data, and then you will make better decisions. So government has found itself in a situation where it has an unexpected massive bonanza of data available to it on its populace, generated substantially by the populace themselves through the snitches in their pockets and through the cheapness and ubiquity of digital sensors as they go about their daily lives, whether in their cars or out on the street. Everything can be measured more cheaply. The results of what you measure can be gathered more cheaply. What government has found, and here I'm thinking chiefly of law enforcement and intelligence services, because that's what I just deal with mostly. What they have found is that it's not the case that they need to follow people around as much as they might used to have done. It's not the case that they need to go and find and check out somebody's library records to find what they have been reading. It's not the case that they need to go and put a bug in their house to find the kind of conversations that they have with their friends. Instead, all of this data is digital and is available and can be exploited either on the front end through data requests to commercial vendors, or even on the back end by law enforcement and intelligence services corrupting the right people within a social media provider or introducing weaknesses in the encryption that commercial companies use that they can then use vulnerabilities to exploit. So they have access to an extraordinary amount of information on people's daily lives. And the legal structures that have been developed, which are primarily the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, though not limited to that, were really premised on a pre-digital world where there wasn't a ton of information out there around individual people. I mean, there was the phone book, which did contain personally sensitive information on everybody. But there wasn't a ton of information on preferences or inclinations or conversations. And what there was difficult and expensive to get. So what you find is that government processes to acquire information directly often require a warrant. There's a judicial process for it. And you have to go and demonstrate probable cause to a judge who will then, in their discretion, issue a warrant or not issue a warrant. For you then to go and seize a person or their papers or their effects. And that is the structure of the Fourth Amendment. But if you can go to a provider, if you can go to a data broker, if you can do a geofence warrant and seize a huge amount of data on a huge amount of people and then winnow it down according to identifiers in the data, then you don't need a warrant for that. You're just purchasing a commercial data set and then applying algorithms to it. So, because of that gap in the law, if you're in law enforcement or intelligence, you'd think this is great. This is fantastic. They can track down so many more of the bad guys than they could before, according to their data profiles. And why wouldn't they want to do it? And more to the point, why would it be helpful for some British-accented jackass to come into the room and tell them that they were doing something wrong by doing it?
Now, in the process of all this, you mentioned geofence warrants, and those are one of the things that I find concerning. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about those.
Right. So, as I said, structure of the Fourth Amendment is the government has some sort of notion that you may be a person who is doing something wrong, that they may wish to prosecute for an actual crime. In order to seize your papers or effects, which include your communications, they need to go and get a warrant, and the warrant has to be particular as to the person and the thing or things to be searched or seized. That's the model. Geofence warrants turn that on its head. Instead, what you have is the government coming to Google and saying, something bad happened in this area that we want to investigate. It happened at this particular time. We want you to draw a line of 200 feet around where this incident occurred, and we want you to give us the mobile phone numbers, the cell phone numbers of all cell phones that passed through that geographical space within a time window of, let's say, an hour before and an hour after this event that happened. And then Google will do that, and then the government will look at those numbers and they will winnow it down and go and cross-reference those numbers in their extensive databases. And they will go back to Google and they'll say, okay, there's one or two of these numbers that are of particular interest to us. We want the location information of where these cell phones went over this longer period. And it might be like three or four of these phones. And then based on that pattern of movements, they go, okay, there's this person who may fit the crime. Let's go pick them up and see what they have to say about it. Now, that means that they're not starting with a person. They are starting with the crime and they're reasoning back. And if you talk to law enforcement about this, then they're a bit like, what do you want me to do? Is it good for me to go and interview like 300 people on the street and take a month about it? Or is it good for me to use this digital means and narrow it down to two or three people who, yeah, okay, I didn't know who they were in advance, but it's good for me to do that and to speed up policing, and it's more efficient. It is more efficient in many ways. The thing is that efficiency is not the only value that is of relevance. If you have a perfectly efficient data gathering and exploitation system that perfectly identifies everyone and where they are at any given moment, and then makes that information easily and seamlessly available to law enforcement, what you have is perfectly efficient policing in some sense, but what you also have is a police state.
Well, that is kind of the definition of perfectly efficient policing now, isn't it?
Well, I have a caveat in my mind about this.
Okay.
There is actually a lot of wisdom in the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment is, in a sense, there not just to slow down policing, but to help policing because it prevents them from being distracted by irrelevant stuff. Digital collection is so cheap and so easy that you can gather the haystack to your heart's content. But the more you gather the haystack, the more false positives you're going to get. Let me give you an example. I live in the Boston area, and the Boston area has something, a police entity called the Boston Regional Intelligence Center. It's a fusion center,
Okay.
for those who know what those are. Part of the mandate they've given themselves is to detect and document threats that are made online that do not rise to the level of illegality under the First Amendment. So they're not illegal things to say, but they might be indicators of future criminal activity. So they intercept a vast array of online comments that are to do with, well, sometimes it's people who are hashtagging the phrase Muslim Lives Matter. Sometimes it's people who are talking about firearms. And they flag this up in the system, and if something looks serious enough, that they go in. I remember a case where there was a 17-year-old teenager in Methuen, Massachusetts. He wanted to be a rapper more than anything in the world. And he called himself DJ Cammy D. And DJ Cammy D put up a rap lyric on his Facebook page. This is a while ago when young people were still using Facebook. And his rap lyric, among other things, said, "Fuck the Boston bombing, I'm going to go one better."
Oh, shit.
And what was this? This was like dumb teenage aspirant rap guy bravado. And DJ Cammy D was never going to be the person who was secretly plotting a series of murderous explosions in our local area. But he got arrested, missed graduation, threatened with charges of making criminal terroristic threats. Local law enforcement got extremely excited because they're like, "We got one."
Yeah, no, you didn't. You got a false alarm.
Yeah. Remarkably, the grand jury refused to indict. And this is a false alarm problem. The more that you collect, the more false alarms that you have. Honestly, this is America. People are talking shit online about how they want to kill their elected officials every day, thousands of times a day. I've lost count of the number of people that I know who have negative opinions about the incoming president, and who sometimes express those in vehement ways. How on earth are you going to wade through all of that if you're collecting everything and then trying to winnow it down? So the philosophy behind the Fourth Amendment is that you don't do it that way. You don't start with mass collection, because it's going to lead to you chasing your tail in case after case after case, and harassing and making the lives miserable of people who may say dumb things on the internet, but who don't pose any realistic threat. You start instead with information that you have developed that a person may pose a realistic threat of committing an actual crime, and then you go seize their communications and see if that backs you up.
That makes too much sense, Alex.
Does it mean that you will sometimes miss stuff? Yes, it does. But does it also mean that you're not going to chase your tail on case after case? Yes, it also means that. So I think that there is a larger sense in which the Fourth Amendment is a friend to law enforcement, if they choose to see it that way, and a friend to the intelligence services.
That is a particularly interesting perspective about it that I had not heard before, so I appreciate you sharing that with me, Alex. We're nearly out of time here, but before we go, I wanted to ask you if you would please give us a quick rundown of what RT4 is doing to improve the situation and how people can connect with the organization.
Yes. So it will not come as a surprise to people who are listening that the US government does collect and exploit vast arrays of data on US citizens. They do. They do their best to tie themselves into knots, to not describe it as that, but they do. The main mechanism whereby Congress considers what to do about this is that the FISA statute, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act statute, regularly comes up for renewal, and it expires if they don't do anything. Now, it's a lot easier to get Congress to not do anything than to get it to do something. If they are going to affirmatively renew it, then they have to actually consider whether it's a good idea and make the time in committee and on the floor to pass it. It's a gigantic headache for them. They'd really prefer, or the intelligence services would really prefer, I should say, for these authorities to just be made permanent so that they could continue warrantlessly surveilling Americans' communications and not have to worry about Congress feeling like it has to weigh in. So what we have is a regular cycle where these powers come up for debate in Congress and members of Congress argue about what to do. We have just had one iteration of this cycle back in April of 2024. I am sorry to say in that cycle that they renewed surveillance powers and in some respects expanded them under FISA. But during the course of that, the vote was closer than it ever had been before. There was a key vote where the House of Representatives was considering, okay, NSA collects all this data and then FBI gets to dip into that data under part of the statute that's called Section 702. They get to dip into what the NSA has collected, even if it's on US persons, and to dip into it for any reason. Could be law enforcement related, doesn't have to be. Could be the FBI agent just is curious about that particular person, or they're visiting the FBI Academy, or they're visiting the FBI headquarters that day. They just can like dip in and see what's going on with that person's communications. So the question was, does the FBI need a warrant in order to dip into the NSA's data when they are doing queries of US person data? And the vote came down to 212 to 212. Because it was an amendment vote, it lost with an even tie. We were actually ahead by one vote, and then the speaker went, oh my God, they're actually going to do something to help the American people. I need to weigh in right now. And he stepped in, voted against a warrant, and banged his gavel to close the vote right there, just to make sure. It had never been the case to that point.
Now, that was during Mike Johnson's tenure?
Yes.
Okay.
This was Mike Johnson. Mm-hmm. Now, of the 212, this is really interesting here, two-thirds of the votes against a warrant were Democrats, and one-third of the votes against the warrant were Republicans. Similarly, of course, two-thirds of the votes for a warrant were Republicans and one-third were Democrats. That was because the Biden administration went all out to pressure legislators to vote against a warrant for U.S. person communications. That's not how it was presented by and large in Democratic Party communications, but that is what they did. So now we have a new situation, right? The next renewal deadline comes up in April 2026. The Republicans are in charge. There's a Republican president. What are those two-thirds of Republicans going to do now? Are they going to continue to support a warrant for U.S. person communications when it is Republicans who are collecting and interpreting this data? Similarly, what are the Democrats going to do? How much of their opposition to a warrant was really like them feeling, oh, you know, Joe's got this. It's going to be okay. The right people are in charge, so we're sure they're not going to do anything bad with it. And how much are they going to change now that it's the Donald who is looking at this data and figuring out what to do with it and how many protesters to harass on the basis of it? There are going to be changes. The question is whether they'll go our way or they won't. It's balanced on a knife edge right now, Chuck. And it could go either way. That is why Restore the Fourth is going to be in there at the core of this fight, contacting members of Congress, trying to render the pro-reform legislators as powerful and as allied a caucus as they can, trying to not only do that, but also to pass data broker protections. Referring back to what we were talking about earlier, there's something called the Fourth Amendment is Not for Sale Act. And what that says is very simple. The House already passed it. We just need them to repass it because we're in a new Congress. What it says is, if the government wants to buy data from a data broker or buy data from a social media provider or whatever, if they just want to buy data on US persons and they would need a warrant to get it if they were acquiring it directly, well, then they need a warrant in order to buy it. It's not saying don't do it. It's just saying you can't weasel out of the protections of the Fourth Amendment just by saying, oh, it's fine, we're going to a third-party provider and paying them some money to get it for us. That's not how this works, Constitution. So warrant protections for U.S. persons' data. FBI doesn't get a free hand to dive into whatever the NSA collects for foreign intelligence purposes. The government, if they want to get U.S. persons' data, then they have to get a warrant for it if they would need a warrant to acquire it directly. And that is what we are looking for. out of this Congress. And people can help. There are very few people who are actually paid people in this space whose paid job it is to advocate for Americans' privacy. And that is part of the problem. Because there are plenty of well-paid people out there advocating against Americans' privacy. So what we need more than anything else is volunteers who are knowledgeable enough about these systems that they know that there's a problem and who are willing to make calls to legislators and coordinate with us to reach out to people of both parties in Congress who might be willing to help pass these critical reforms. We're close. We're closer than we've ever been. I can feel it. And I believe that this can happen, but it's not going to happen without there being volunteers of goodwill involved in the process because nothing ever happens without there being volunteers of goodwill. You know what I mean?
I do. Now, how does one volunteer?
That's very simple. You go to restoretheforth.com. That's four as a digit rather than spelled out. And there is a tab saying get involved. And you put information in there that will enable us to contact you. And I say that carefully because we cheerfully accept pseudonyms and acronyms just as long as we are able to contact you. And we will have a chat with you if you'd sign up and try to plug you in a way that you can do stuff that is practical and useful and that will not waste your time. This is a cause that is desperately important, a cause that gets desperately misreported in the press, and that lawmakers make hay of because they don't understand it, or they pretend just that the more that we gather in terms of information, the safer we are. People like your audience, Chuck, and people like the people involved in Restore the Fourth, we understand that that's not so. And there are nearly enough lawmakers who are with us. We just need to get it over that hump.
So one last thing before we go. My audience is an audio-only audience, so they are not going to be able to see this wonderful t-shirt you are wearing. Tell us a little bit about your t-shirt.
Oh, that's just a merch t-shirt, but it's a black t-shirt and it has in white 3D lettering on the front. I do not consent to a search.
Fantastic stuff.
We have seen people who wear these shirts going through TSA checkpoints at the airport and then posting about their experience about it and going, yeah, actually wearing this shirt, like not only was I able to not consent to having my image gathered for facial recognition purposes, but other people around me realized that they also had the option to refuse if they want it. Because like TSA doesn't make a big thing of your ability to refuse this, right? Not in their interest to do so. So we think that the t-shirts are good praxis. They encourage people to be mindful of the rights that they really do have, and that the government has spent a number of decades dishonoring systematically.
Alex Matthews, thank you very much for your time this evening.
Thank you very much, Chuck.